If you want to adopt a more magical worldview, fantasy fiction is a good place to start. So let me tell you about one of my favorites, the All Souls trilogy by Deborah Harkness. They've got this dark academia vibe going on. Harkness is a professor of European history and Renaissance science, and her heroine, Diana Bishop, is also a historian and a witch. We first meet her at Oxford's Bodleian Library, where she accidentally calls up an enchanted alchemical manuscript and meets her love interest, Professor Matthew Claremont, eminent genetic biologist and 1,500-year-old vampire. I have read the series more than once. I've watched the TV series more than once. And now Deborah Harkness is back with a new installment, The Blackbird Oracle. When it opens, Diana and Matthew have been married 7 years. Their twins are about to turn 6, and then one day, a dead raven drops from the sky in front of Diana and Becca, followed by its mate with a magical gift. Here's how it begins.
The sizable raven landed safely on the pavement before us, light and sure-footed. The bird's feathers shone deeply black with a hint of darkest blue that reminded me of Becca's hair. With a snap of its formidable beak, the raven cocked its head. Becca returned the gesture. Cautiously, she approached the bird. "Careful," I murmured, unsure of its intentions. The ravens in the trees cried out with loud craw craws. Becca crouched by the dead bird. Its lively companion took a few two-footed hops to narrow the distance between them and strutted back and forth, emitting a bubbling stream of chatter. It picked something out of the dead raven's beak and dropped it before her. It was a ring. "Don't touch it," I cried. I tried to probe the nature of the magic, sending out inquisitive feelers in the hope of identifying it, but it was smoky and murky, without clear intentions or any discernible knotted structure. It had a strange scent, too. Sea salt, pine, barberries, and brimstone all garbled together. Given the enchantment unfolding around us, the ravens had not come to Orange Street by accident. Someone had sent them, and they had come bearing a gift for my daughter. I had learned the hard way that magical gifts always came with strings attached.
What a fantastic beginning. And I love it that magic has a smell.
Oh, yes. Magic definitely has a smell. I sense a little touch of it after a rainstorm, that kind of clean, bright, anticipatory smell that comes after a rainstorm with a few extra ingredients thrown in there.
So this raven arrives with a message and with an invitation from an aunt that Diana never knew she had to meet a side of the family she didn't really even know still existed, the Proctors. That's how you bring in both a whole new trove of family secrets and a world of powerful new magic, a whole other side of her identity as a witch, which seems incredibly challenging for you as a writer, having already invented one kind of magic. Now you set yourself the challenge of inventing a second kind of magic.
Well, this is higher, darker magic, which we know Diana is somewhat frightened of. She associates it with very negative experiences in her life. She's had brushes with it over the course of the previous novels. And I'm really intrigued by this notion of what is dark magic. Mm-hmm. And it led me into a lot of very interesting paths about human psychology and about shadow and concepts like shadow work, which are very much part of modern Wiccan beliefs, that all have to do with facing the darkness that is inside you as a way of being more able to touch the light.
Were you wanting to kind of push back on this concept of light as good and dark as bad?
I think I wanted people to think about the ways that light and dark had to coexist, and that we need to find ways not to deny darkness, whether it's in our nation's heritage or our personal past or any of our family legacies. We need to find a way not to pretend it's not there. We don't want to just focus so much on the light that we are not equipped to deal in an honest way with who we are. And I look around me in the world as a historian, and I see an awful lot of denial mm-hmm. and inability to face what are just part of our human story. They're terrible parts of the human story, but we have to tell them, we have to hear them, and then we have to figure out where we go from there.
Well, it's interesting that some of the historical shadow work you're doing in this case is going back to the history of the Salem witch trials. I don't know if it was in the course of writing this book or earlier, but you discovered that you, in fact, yourself are a descendant of one of the women accused, right?
Yeah, I have given countless interviews about how I had no connection to Salem, which was true at that time. I did not know I had a connection to Salem. But I discovered during the pandemic that I am descended from not one, but two accused witches.
Oh, wow.
One executed, one who languished in jail because she couldn't afford to pay the jail for her upkeep during her incarceration.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was not until a kind soul freed her by paying her jail room and board fees. Can you imagine that she was allowed out?
What were their names?
One of them is Elizabeth Jackson Howe, and one of them is wonderful, Mehitable Braybrook.
Oh, Mehitable, what a fabulous name.
Isn't it wonderful? She was the illegitimate daughter of a relationship between a master and an indentured servant. So not a slave, but a white indentured servant who was utterly dependent and in bondage for 7 years. A term bondage, not a life bondage, as in slavery. And he and she had a relationship. She got pregnant with what would soon be Mehitable Braybrook. And the court ordered that the master and his wife raise that illegitimate child as if it were their own.
That seems very progressive for that period of time.
Well, I don't know. I think the stepmother in Puritan New England may not really have liked having the child of a servant that she had to raise as her own daughter. Mehitable drank too much, and she had foul language, and she was a total Salem character, which is how most people end up in the Salem trials and implicated in them.
I think I first read about the Salem witch trials probably as a teenager reading The Witch mm-hmm. of Blackbird Pond. So I'm guessing there has been a whole lot more historical work done on not just the Salem witch trials, but the witch trials in Europe over the last 20, 30 years or more. How have ideas about the witch trials changed?
We know a lot more. At first, there was a kind of belief that many of the women who were accused of being witches were midwives or healers. There's a very famous book, The Midwife and the Witch. As we got more and more of the trial records, we discovered there are young women and old women. There are men and women. There are healers and there are merchants and there are women who run ale houses. It's not as simple as that.
But I thought it was always supposed to be women who were kind of outcast to begin with. They were elderly. They were poor. They lived on the margins of the villages, and so they were easy victims.
There's a bit of truth in that, but I think it's become shorthand for what is honestly a much more complicated picture. Outcasts include people like Martha Carrier, who happened to have been married to a 7-foot-tall husband.
7 feet.
7 feet. They would not have really known what to make of him. Is he a giant? Is he a monster? Why did God do this to him? We're talking Puritan New England, and in many cases, radically Protestant Europe. The Protestants who execute most of the witches, it's not the Catholics. So there's all of these sort of generalizations that we make about them, that when you peel underneath them, as with most cases in history, you find out it's really much more complicated. I would not say that they were outcasts. I would say that most of the people who were accused of witchcraft and executed were people who made their neighbors uncomfortable.
So the thing I don't understand at the same time is that I've always kind of thought that a witch is a figure of power. All the stories I've ever read, they can do magic and they have access to a kind of power that other people don't. But the stories about the witch trials, it doesn't sound like it's people who have power who are being persecuted. It sounds like it's people who are in some way or another powerless. So what's the dynamic around women and power and witchcraft?
This is a subject very near and dear to my heart. It is actually because people who are different occupy a lot of space rent-free in people's heads. They worry about the little old lady who lives down the lane and the recent immigrant who's come to town and somebody who's of a different ethnicity. You worry and worry and worry, and you build them up into your head into something so other that you start attributing your bad misfortunes to them. People who are different have enormous power in our culture. I think for anyone who has ever veered away from a homeless person in the street, that is a power move on their part. We are so afraid to come into contact with them. We alter our course. We've just given that individual, we've ceded a fair amount of power. So what I always tell my students is that power isn't a thing. You don't pick it up and wield it. Power is a set of relationships. And sometimes the harder you try to make someone marginal, the more powerful they become.
More than any of your other books, really, I think this one is very rooted in a landscape. There's such a strong sense of place when you write about Ipswich, Massachusetts, this landscape where the Proctors, Diana's other magical family, it's a place that they've lived for generations and generations. You know, there are ghosts of ancestors who walk the land. How did you get such a strong sense of that place? Is it a place you know really well?
It's a place that kept popping up when I was reading through all of the Salem trial records. And Ipswich is a very liminal landscape. And by that, I mean, there's water, there's marsh, and there's land. And so there are these in-between parts of the landscape that will appear and disappear over the course of a day. One day you can walk out to an island, and the next day you would have to take a boat.
Oh, wow.
So there's this kind of shifting landscape. It's also 1692. We're very, very close to the first white colonial settlers coming to the New World. They're surrounded by the indigenous culture. There are people who we believe had an indigenous background in the trials. So it's a very particular place.
Going back to the particular magic that the Proctors do, this higher magic, the way you write about it feels very elemental. It's something that flows from the natural world.
Absolutely. Most people in the past believed that there was a designer behind the world, some kind of plan. So there is design in nature, a vitalistic landscape, one in which we see things animated. I had a wonderful experience to talk to a member of a Native American tribe who was telling me about her culture's belief in two-legged people and four-legged people and winged people and standing people. And standing people are trees and plants. One of the things that is true about my books is that both Diana and Matthew are students of how the world works, what their place in it is, and how they can understand that better, which makes them both natural philosophers.
All right, I have to let you go, but may I ask you for one more short reading? I have something in mind based on what you just said.
Okay.
All right. This is the beginning of chapter 10. It's page 146.
All right. So Diana has come to Ravenswood and has learned that one of her Aunt Gwyneth's desires for her time there is that she would be introduced to the study of higher magic and really accept that this too is part of her lineage. And she starts to sort of process that through the lens of watching how the proctors engage with magic. So I'll start reading from there. When Gwyneth adjusted the windows to let in the breeze, she sprinkled salt on the windowsills. When she crossed a threshold, her lips moved in silent blessing. Each morning, when she made her first cup of tea, my aunt tucked a sprig of rosemary into the frames of the ancestral portraits. Gwyneth told time by the rising and setting of the moon, not the sun, her hours tied to the goddess's rhythms. During my first few days at Ravenswood, I'd wake after midnight and she would be out walking the meadow, staring out to sea. Higher magic wasn't a bag of tricks the proctors pulled out at Halloween. It was their way of life.
I love that so much, and I have to thank you for giving us Gwyneth. What a marvelous role model for an older woman.
Anyone who has ever been to a women's college and has met a feisty alum from the class of 1930 will instantly recognize Gwyneth as one of those indomitable gray-haired ladies in their Talbot summer wear who literally could organize an army, run three countries, raise a family, cook a chicken dinner, and not break a sweat.
As a graduate of Bryn Mawr College, this is who I aspire to be.
I did not know that I was talking to a sister. Well, there you go. That is, you know then. You know women like Gwyneth. My favorite thing about them is that when they show up from reunion, the first thing they do is throw open the trunk and call out, Trixie, do you want a martini? Oh, they're the whole package.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. This has been such a pleasure.
I could talk to you for hours. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thanks. That's Deborah Harkness, professor of European history and Renaissance science, and author of the best-selling All Souls trilogy. The newest volume is The Blackbird Oracle.